Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk show host, Randy Fine. Today's special guest, Dr. Christopher Kerr, has cared for thousands of patients who, in the face of death, experience end-of-life dreams and visions that are unlike any other. Described as more real than real, these end-of-life experiences resurrect past relationships, meaningful events, and the themes of love and forgiveness, restores life's meaning and mark the transition from distress to comfort and acceptance. Drawing on interviews with over 1,400 patients and more than a decade of quantified data for the evidence-based and peer-reviewed published study, Dr. Kerr reveals that pre-death dreams and visions are extraordinary occurrences that humanize the dying process. He shares how his patients' stories point to death as not solely about the end of life, but as the final chapter of humanity's transcendence. Dr. Kerr's book, Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End, also illuminates the benefit of these phenomena for the bereaved who find solace in seeing their loved ones pass with a sense of calm closure. Dr. Kerr is the CEO and Chief Medical Officer at Hospice Buffalo. He was born and raised in Toronto, and he earned his MD as well as a PhD in neurobiology and completed his residency in internal medicine at the University of Rochester. And we're going to talk about the research that he has done. And just as an aside, he lives on a horse farm on a small town of East Aurora, New York. So let me introduce my special guest to you so we can get started. Good morning, Dr. Kerr. Welcome.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Oh, it is my absolute pleasure. This is a topic that I find so intriguing, so fascinating, but am fully on board with the belief. So, I am open, and I believe a lot of my listeners are too. So, you started off as an intern resident at the cardiology department, and what made you decide to switch this over and pursue a career in hospice medicine?
Well, I I ended up at hospice in an unusual way. I was I had two young children and was trying to support my family while I was a cardiology fellow, and needed a weekend job, and actually saw an ad in a newspaper. And I remember thinking, you know, who advertises for a doctor in a newspaper? And the real question is, who answers it? But so I started doing hospice work, not really knowing what was involved. Ironically, I had petitioned to get out of the rotation when I was a resident. And so I really came here looking for extra income while I was going through my fellowship. And I was deeply moved really very early by the overwhelming need of patients who were essentially abandoned by the medical system when they were no longer curative, families who were struggling to cope and manage in ways they didn't know what to expect. And so instead of finding very little to do, I found there was an overwhelming amount to do, and it was deeply meaningful. And so after moonlighting on the weekends for about 6 months, I decided to make a switch and make this my life's work, and I've never looked back. It's been 20 years.
That's amazing. I'm the mother of a surgical resident, and so I understand what you went through to get to the fellowship. So it's medical school, then it's residency, and then you were in a fellowship. And so I understand the magnitude of abandoning all those years of one particular study in pursuit of a passion that you had. But it is a very noble passion. Your first experience with the phenomena we're going to talk about was with your dying father when you were 12. And he was a doctor as well. Did his did what you experienced with him, do you think that shaped your career direction?
No, I think it actually put me in the other direction. It was something that I was so traumatized. I was 12 when he died, and I really couldn't find words to describe what I was experiencing, and I didn't speak of it. I think if anything, I was averse to death. And as I say in the book, if you're averse to dying, medical school is a pretty safe place to be. And so I ended up on the interventional side and acute side of medicine. And, you know, there was death, but you weren't caring for the dying in the same way you do with hospice. Really, the people at the bedside are nurses and social workers and pastoral care providers and less physicians. So, it certainly haunted me, but I think at a subconscious level I was probably averse to it. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
You make a statement in the beginning of your book that I am a doctor and all my patients die. Despite the tremendous loss inherent in these words, there is light within the darkness of dying. So I like that statement. So what is that light?
Well, I think when we contemplate death, we immediately go to what we observe or experience, which is we anticipate physical suffering and grief. So I think, and it's defined medically in terms of organ failure. So I think that overwhelmingly we're biased towards viewing the dying process as failing parts, when really it's a closing of a life. And so we tend to focus on what's outward but not what's experienced, not on the subjective. So there's this whole other dimension to dying, which is the subjective inner experiences of dying that patients go through. And that's the part that contains some light.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. One of the first cases that you talk about is Mary, and he said that her physical ills couldn't be cured, but it appeared that her spiritual wounds were being tended to. How was that so?
Well, yeah, Mary was the case that really changed how I viewed this. And very briefly, she had four children, and they were all around the bedside day and night. And they were very communicative with one another, and then she started to hold and coo to a baby that we couldn't see. And she referred to him as Danny, and she was clearly comforted. And the children didn't understand the reference or who Danny was. And then her sister came in from out of town and explained that Danny was her first child who was stillborn, and which she never spoken about. So she had carried this lifelong injury, and in the end, she's comforted and in some way healed. So it's this paradox of dying. She's physically lessening and declining, yet spiritually she's tended to.
That is so beautiful. And as I read that, it was just so touching the way you describe, you know, her actually, I mean, you really saw her holding this baby and, you know, caressing this baby and really loving this baby. What a beautiful experience for her. Another one of your earlier hospice experiences was with Peter, who had pancreatic cancer. This struck me because you said he received little care overnight and his medications had not been reviewed or adjusted. And then you talk about how his terminal diagnosis had become a liability because it obscured the management of other conditions that were actually treatable. You know, when I was a hospice volunteer, I have one situation that really stood out, and there was a patient who was dying of cancer, and she was non-communicative. Her family had been there the night before, but nobody was there overnight. The woman was squirming and reeling and moaning in pain, and I kept going to the desk of this facility and saying, she needs medication, she needs medication. And they kept saying, all right, we'll get to it, we'll get to it, we'll get to it. I was there for hours watching this woman writhe in pain, and nobody cared. And, you know, and I thought to myself, yes, her family was here the night before, and they assumed that she's going to be maintained. So, you say that the decision to pursue palliative care is tragically often interpreted as a consent to do nothing. So elaborate on that from your point of view.
Sure, sure. The our entire health system and culture is, even its economics, are based on doing things. And you can get $1 million world-class care as long as you're viewed curative. When you're no longer curative, you fall off a cliff, and you're often sent home to face the end of your life without supportive care. We tend to view dying patients in terms of a singular disease entity, so it gets its top billing. So, for example, in Peter's case, it was cancer. Well, he also had diabetes and high blood pressure. And because he was no longer curative, he was no longer being seen and reviewed regularly. And what happened was, as is often the case with cancer, he ends up losing over 50 pounds. So his blood pressure goes from high to low. His blood sugar goes low. And every time he's trying to get up and do something, and he loved to participate in these political discussions that were at the adult home that he was at, he actually couldn't function. He had no quality of life. And it's not sophisticated medicine, it's very simple medicine, but he needed those things adjusted because biologically he had actually changed more in the preceding 6 months than probably in the preceding 20 years. And it's just this notion that we tend to put people on the shelf after they're still living, but we consider them non-treatable, so there isn't a reason to address. It's hard, for example, to get into a hospital because you're feeling sick. You need an identifiable, codable diagnosis on which to bill. So the whole system is predicated on doing things to people as opposed to caring for people. That's why you can get MRI imaging, you know, weeks before death, even though it's probably not going to change your management, but it's hard to get care in the home. So we have a interesting model of care of healthcare that doesn't necessarily do a good job of caring for those who are terminal and no longer want to seek aggressive management. We see people, for example, dying of urinary tract infections. constipation. They're just no longer being cared for because they were told the worst words of medicine, which is there's nothing more we can do for you. There may be nothing more we can do for the overriding disease, but there's always a lot to do for the patient, particularly at the end of life.
And you were also saying that when the patient, if and when the patient comes home, that often the family is not equipped to properly care for the patient or the family member. So what is your experience with that? What should we know if we have a situation like that? What is it that we need to know?
Well, I think what's missing is honest and open communication. I said in the book, it's not uncommon for me to see families who know how much parking is at the local hospital, but when they leave with their loved one, they actually don't know how they're going to die. So there's not enough, there's just not enough open and honest information that's disclosed. There needs to be more of that. And people in their role as advocates need to actually go there and ask these questions. It's often the case that the doctor really has a very good understanding of timeline, but that's not shared. It's an antiquated model where people feel that, you know, if you tell people bad news, you're taking away hope. But what actually happens is they're not fooled. They go home and hope for recovery fades, and they're faced with tragedy. And that's better dealt with when it's dealt with honestly. I find over again there's just this void of information, and that void is filled with fear. So what people anticipate the dying process to be is actually far worse than what it is. For most people, it's a lessening. It's eating less and sleeping more. And people anticipate pain to be far and away the greatest symptom, when for many people it's not. So there's just this lack of accurate information and understanding of what to expect.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. People have a hard time talking about death and dying. Most people do. And they don't really want to bring it up, you know, so it's the elephant in the room. Let's talk about Maya. So in regard to her confusion about the meaning of her end-of-life dreams and visions, you said, "We live in a world where seeing is believing and where methodically collected data and evidence are prerequisites for any scientific mind." So there was no data-driven research at the time that you started. So you did start some kind of research project, right, or some kind of interview process, right?
Right. Very quickly, what happened was I, as soon as I started working at hospice, it seemed like everybody but me was aware that the patients who were dying were having end-of-life experiences. And to be honest with you, I didn't. And I went looking in the literature, and what I found was interesting. It has been mentioned throughout time in the humanities, but very little within the medical domain. There were lots of reports that were anecdotal, books that were written, but they were kind of story-based or clinical vignettes, but nothing that you would consider as evidence. And that becomes very important because what happened was I was trying to educate students and residents and fellows, and their reply was always they wanted to medicalize this as a confusional state, blame it on medications, etc. And their answer was, well, there was no evidence. And that's actually what drove the first study, was I took a very methodologic approach to looking at this phenomena and in order to gather evidence so that it would be validated and hopefully accepted and understood.
Yeah, the seeing is believing. I think that's sort of changing. I think more people are being open to it, but still, those at their end of life begin to speak about, many people think are delusions. And I remember I was working with this one patient, and I was supposed to go see him, and his live-in companion called me, and she said, don't come because he's having hallucinations, and we need to get that under control. And I said, oh, what is he hallucinating about? And she says, well, he keeps seeing all these women in white flying up towards the ceiling. This whole, you know, he's thinking of them as the church ladies. And I'm thinking to myself, they're angels. He's seeing angels. And they're putting him on medication to stop the hallucinations. And I know you've experienced this. And he died very shortly after that. So
the risk there,
yeah.
Sorry, is that you end up sterilizing people from their own experience.
Yeah.
It gets complicated in that delirium, true confusional states, are very, very common in going from life to death. But what people miss is those are common events towards the very end of life, usually. And this is where people also critique this work. They'll say, well, it's a deoxygenated brain or it's medication. The patients that we have in our studies, we start interviewing them often months before death. They're driving their cars. They're doing their taxes. So vantage point is everything. We're not talking about people just pre-death. We're talking them in the dying process far more upstream. And in our studies, they have to complete certain consent forms and screens for confusion. So they're very much intact. And then lastly, what we did, our concern was so great that people were going to view them as feeble-minded or confused or broken that we videotaped them. And they sound a lot like you and I right now. So they're very much intact. But you're right. The case you described is exactly that. The fact that somebody's having another experience that we may not be able to share doesn't mean it's not meaningful or comforting. And that's really the question to ask.
Right. And I think it was causing him anxiety, which is why they were suspicious of it. You know, and that was something I couldn't understand. He was wrestling with his visions and really feeling like something was wrong with having them. But I can't help but wonder if it was the people around him who were making him uncomfortable with that. You said in your study you found that more than a third of your participants identified travel or preparing to leave as a common theme in their dreams and visions. And you also said the absence of a travel destination was typically a source of peace, not anxiety. So what is this travel about? What kind of examples can you give us to tell us about
sure,
that?
Sure. I think we've heard of every mode of travel imaginable, from canoes to planes and trains. A common theme is that they're driving around a neighborhood of their childhood. It's this notion that they're packing, or so it's this notion that they're preparing to go or actually in transition. And I think two points are really fascinating. The metaphor is so obvious, you know, it's that you are transitioning. But two things happen. One, people don't seem to make that connection. They just seem to enjoy the experience, it's not confusing or hurtful to them or unsettling. It's just, and oftentimes it includes a guide, so somebody who is pre-deceased, who's providing reassurance and seemed to be leading the way. We did a study where we qualitatively broke down the themes, and that was a very common one.
So the travel destination, the absence of a travel destination was a source of peace. So in other words, what would that look like, the absence of a destination?
Just that the people will often say, you know, I don't know why, but I was in my my parents' car and we were driving around the old neighborhood. I don't know where we were going. Or my dad and I were in a canoe. We were going down a river, not sure where we're going. This uncertainty seems to be acceptable. They don't wake up with angst. And actually, it's a theme of this work, which is really interesting, which is people don't come out of this with questions. They emerge with having answers or having felt something that was tangible. I mean, if you think about it, the time for therapy or analysis is over. So these are very different dreams in that sense. They don't wake up with inquiry. They awake with almost an understanding.
Okay. That's so comforting to all of us, you know.
Yeah.
It really is to know that we sort of, our spiritual self helps us to resolve these things that have been within us, these problems and issues that have been within us for so long. You also said that 45% of pre-death experiences occurred during sleep, 16% took place during wakefulness, and more than 39% happened in both states. But in all cases, your patients talked about their end-of-life experiences as the most awake, alert, and present they have ever felt.
Yes, one of the things we did is we had a scale on our survey instruments where we asked them to gauge reality. So from 0 to 10, how realistic did it appear? And it scored close to 10 nearly across the board. And one of the things they were most adamant about was that these weren't dreams, that these were actual experiences. They were virtual, they were lived, they were tangible. The part that was always interesting was that they said they often occurred when they were awake, but it wasn't as though when you walk in the room they're pointing to people that we don't see. And we think what's happening is that their dying includes changes in level of alertness and sleep's architecture. And we think maybe they're coming in and out of sleep states and in a way are experiencing lucid dreaming, a type of dreaming that's very intense. But the realism is key. The thing that we hear all the time is people will say, I don't normally recall my dreams, but this is what I experienced. It was vivid. And the other theme is that often very little is said between the people in the dreams, but a great deal seems to be understood.
Yeah, I know that that these patients often gaze up into the corner. You know, they're gazing sort of up to the ceiling, up to the corner, you know, and people are wondering what they're looking at because they may not be making eye contact with anyone, but they seem to be looking at something.
Right. You describe it as having two planes, right? They're able to carry on conversations at the same time they're looking through you or away and very fixed.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So you say that end-of-life dreams are categorically distinct from normal dreams. So, and you talked about the distinction of they just feel real. You know, you remember them, they feel real. So is there a way to explain that to a caretaker? Like, how would you tell them? Yeah. How would you tell them what's
different? Yeah, there is. I think the first thing that needs to happen is that they're normalized that they're given permission to occur or space to occur. So simply saying that, you know, it's very, very common for people who are facing the end of life to have these experiences. Otherwise, people, there's certainly a subgroup of people who are very off-put by watching their loved ones make references to things they don't see. So I think normalizing it and humanizing it is really, really important. It's amazing what a difference it makes at the bedside. You know, I had somebody recently who the daughter was sitting in the corner of the room and her mother speaking in Polish, her native language, which is not uncommon. And the daughter seemed really discomforted. This is her mother and she's seen her, you know, making references she doesn't understand. I explained it to her, and the next day I come in, and she's right at the bedside. It's supposed to be the corner of the room, and she's taking notes. And she's hearing for the first time about a lot of her mother's childhood memories, the pets she had, her grandparents she would have known, friends. You know, she's reliving in an intense fashion all of these early wonderful experiences. And it provided almost this connectivity. It puts dying in this perspective because it's you're really, it's a tie back. So it's from you know, the child to the mother to the mother's parents, and it just it weaves this course. It's very interesting.
Oh, it is really interesting. So these, you know, these dreams and visions fulfill the patient's needs, and it could be whether they're to be forgiven, to be loved, or to be granted peace. How is that affected for when they're not validated? Do they still feel the same peace, or does it create a frustration and a confusion for them?
You mean if they're distressing?
If they're feeling these peaceful things, if they're coming to these, you know, experiencing their lost loved ones, and they're feeling peaceful and they're being forgiven and everything, and then they're talking about it to the living, and the living is saying, you know, stop talking about that, they're not alive. What does that do to the peace of mind of the patient?
I think that's a great question. I think so dying is inherently isolating. Not being validated or believed makes it more so. And there's actually some data that people withhold these experiences for fear of being judged or ridiculed, particularly from their clinical team. So I think that, if you think about it, none of us have experienced dying. They are, and we're not in a position to judge what's actually their experience. I've certainly seen that. I've seen people dismissed from it, I think it makes them confused and lonely and detached. We see the whole spectrum, and we have a lot of videos of these sorts of patients. There's some people who are just, you know, out there and share every little detail with all their family members like they went on a journey last night. And when you see what it means not only for the patient, but then what you see is for what it means to the bereaved, it recontextualizes or reframes the dying process, because what actually ends up happening, instead of viewing it as only life lost, it actually affirms having lived. And that matters.
Yes, it does. I'm laughing as I'm thinking back to a little story you told about this really outgoing woman who you walked into the room. I think this was in the beginning, and she was complaining about the pink spiders on the wall and how they were upsetting her. And you said to her, "I don't see any pink spiders." And she said,
yeah.
"Good." You know, basically, because they weren't there, she was trying to trick you. And then someone else came in and just said, "Oh, yes, I see them." That was funny. I like that story.
Yeah, her name was Bobby, and she was tethered to her bed with a Foley and an IV, but she made the world pretty interesting by essentially testing the doctors. And it just points to the difficulty in trying to relate to unshared worlds. And so, yeah, she would test everybody who came in and ask them if they saw the pink spiders. And if you said yes, she would tell you you needed a doctor. So. The importance there is it's the perspective that matters. And the only one that matters is really the patient.
Okay.
That's the lesson.
Exactly. That's so true. Okay, yeah. Let's talk about Eddie. So his story made visible that the end of life experiences are never singular events, that you know, can't view them as a snapshot any more than from an outsider's perspective, that they require the widest of lenses. They're circuitous, enmeshed, relational, protracted, and all time and at times accessible. All right, well, anyway, yeah.
I think the point is, we die as we live.
Right.
And it's not always pleasant, and all of us have wounds, have been hurt, done things wrong, have regret, guilt, and that you can't define life and that you led it in a single vignette. And Eddie was a very complicated soul. He was a policeman who had done some very wrong things. All of them came back to him in a torment, and he had such a complex dying process psychologically that he actually had guns removed from his house. He went to a psychiatric facility briefly. He just assumed that he was going to hell, and all those sorts of things. So he relived every element that was bad within his life. But as is often the case, that seems to be important because he came out the other side better. I think what defined his dying most was that he was entirely self-focused, which is unusual for dying people because usually their concerns changes from self to others. But he was really just looking inward. And then towards the end, he was so fearful of death, and towards the end he started to announce his death, but in a positive way. And instead of talking about himself, he made deliberate attempts to reach out to those he loved and to express uncomplicated, unconditioned love. And so he fought hard to get to a better place, but he got there. And it was largely through these experiences.
Very memorable, I'm sure, for you and everyone that worked with him. You dedicated an entire chapter to end-of-life experiences for the mentally ill, demented, disabled, or neuroatypical, people whose voices and stories are often hidden and marginalized in life. So share some of that with us, how
sure,
different that is or the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, that actually was really important to me personally, because one of the things that happens is when you're doing research, it's very hard to include people who have any sort of cognitive compromise because they need to consent and that sort of thing. I mean, the idea is right. You know, you're protecting them from studies if they can't understand all the ramifications. On the other hand, they're tragically misrepresented in research. And I think a lot gets lost because of it. So I discussed several patients, and one of the ones that's most striking is a young lady who had Down syndrome. And I think what gets lost in all these patients is they may not have our same level of cognitive function, but they have emotional lives. There's an emotional self. We tend to define these folks by their deficits rather than what they do have. And she was a case in point. So she ended up having a GYN cancer that resulted in a lot of fluid accumulation in her belly. So she had a protuberant abdomen. And she was always very maternalistic. Those instincts with her were remarkably strong. So she always carried a baby with her and would kiss, coo, changed the baby, and as her disease got worse and her belly became more protuberant, we would have difficult conversations because we wanted to understand where she was at from a pain perspective, etc., and wanted her to have some kind of insight. And what she did was she always reframed it in terms of being pregnant and that this was her baby kicking. And this only was strengthened after she would sleep and close her eyes. So here she is facing the end of her life, but it was recontextualized that she was giving life. So she did have this inner self. She did have this emotional life, and it was strong, and it was powerfully human, and it had nothing to do with her level of cognitive function.
That is so fascinating. If someone is suffering dementia, often, you know, at this point, they're really not communicating, and if they are, they're communicating in a very confusing way. So how do you assess that? How do you know what's going on with them?
I think we ask the wrong questions. So there's a currency when we medically speak of demented patients in terms of what their level of cognitive function is. So we ask them questions like who the president is or the date or whatever. And those really aren't the right questions. The questions that matter are you comfortable? Do you feel safe? those sorts of things. The questions that go to what their experience is, not what they know. It's interesting. A lot of folks with dementia, obviously, they have trouble forming new memories, so their recent memory is limited. So they can't tell you what you had for breakfast, but they can tell you the gown they wore at their high school prom. So the more you can place them there and relate to them there and relate to them at an emotional level in a distant past, the more vibrant and alive they actually are. There's more of them there. They're just not there recently. They're there in a past. And that's why in the book I describe somebody who had lost a child at age 3. And as she became more detached from a current reality, she actually was more entrenched in the distant past where the child was alive. And there was a portrait of him, and she would blow kisses to the portrait of her lost child. And that actually she became happier as she was dying because she was more entrenched at that time when she was a mother and her child was tangible to her. And actually what ends up happening was towards the end, she disliked her new self so much that the family had to put drapes over the mirror so she didn't have to see the old woman in the mirror she didn't no longer recognize. She was back to a time when her life was rich with love. So in that sense, I don't think it's relevant what she knows or can recall, but it matters a great deal what she's experiencing and feeling.
You know, what I found really interesting when I was volunteering in hospice is that when I could communicate with the patients, the lives of these people, you see this person who's lost a lot of weight, they're very frail, they're very fragile, you know, they don't look like who they were. And then you talk to them and you hear they were professors and they were this and they were that and they had this life experience. Their life experiences are so rich, but when you see this person lying there, it doesn't look that way. And that's kind of what I related to what you were just saying. It's like that's not who that person is. But unless you look past that and really ask these people who they are and what they remember, you don't know how rich their lives were.
No, and I think that may be getting worse in our culture. Just as an aside, I mean, we're a very ageist society, and compared to other cultures and other times, we don't honor our elders in the same way. I think that's true. We're so youth-driven. It's amazing what some wrinkles and a medical gown do to lessen somebody's value. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I found that so fascinating, because I would be sitting there for hours, so I would really talk to these people and find out who they were. There was one woman, she was home, and her two daughters were taking care of her, and they were just tired. They needed a break, so they called me to come over. And she was so agitated. She wasn't communicating with anyone, but she was so agitated. And I had seen when I walked in through the apartment that she had all kinds of Frank Sinatra mementos, just all kinds of things. So I asked her daughter, does she like Frank Sinatra music? And they said, oh, yes. I said, put it on. And they put it on, and she just eased right into sleep. It was so cool. Such a little thing. So let's see. Oh, I wanted to – okay, so you say that patients' end-of-life experiences provide answers to questions that no longer need asking. They represent a culminating point rather than a doorway. And I think you probably explained that, but I just wanted to bring that up because I liked that comment, that quote. What's the difference between a culminating point and a doorway?
Well, I think it's the idea that these experiences don't leave you needing a next question. There is no next question. It's a summation rather than an inquiry. And I think that's great for a couple of reasons. One is that it seems to be the both the question and the answer reside in the self. So they're not dependent on making an appointment to see a psychologist or the priest. And that it's their life and it's their experience. And it all seems to be contained there. And practically, it makes sense because they're running out of time. And it's really a nice way to finish with a true finale rather than a play that needs the next act. And that's the difference.
And writing that this book, Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End, you said that you learned that the only point of view that matters is that of the patient, and the notion that patients who are thought to be silent may in fact be the only people worth listening to. another great line. I mean, I wrote down so many of your really great lines. So what do you mean when you say patients who are thought to be silent may be the only people worth listening to?
Well, I think it actually goes to what you were just saying, that we tend to view people who are in gowns and in bed in almost a paternalistic way about what they need as defined by our frame of reference rather than theirs. The patient that you turned on the Frank Sinatra. And so it's defining the reality from their perspective is what matters, I guess is what I'm saying, not from ours.
Okay.
And I think what happens is the risk with patients is that they're medicalized, and when you're medicalized, there's something wrong with you rather than knowing what's right with you. And there's a difference.
Wow. If only people would understand that. Wow. So you say that you fully embrace, you can't say that you fully embrace the notion of a good death. There's no such thing as a good death, only good people. Death and dying are mere extensions of what came before. We die as we live. Another really, that's probably the last quote I wrote down, but so a good death. I mean, let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I just don't know about, I mean, I guess it depends how you use it. There's certainly bad deaths where people aren't managed for pain and everything like that. But that's, again, almost a more medical definition of it. But a good death is one that's your own, you know, one in which you have a say. One in which you're understood, that you're valued, that you can be loved and express love. And it's not a degree of goodness or badness if somebody's had a tortured existence and they exist. They shouldn't be judged. It's not realistic that we define their end of life by our notions of good. It's relevant only in it as it matters to that person and what their experience is. So that's what I meant, is that I don't know if there's a good death, but they're just good people.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, it does. Yeah, my son was asked to round on a patient. He was asked to do a favor for a doctor, to go round on a patient who had, she had other issues, but she had trouble swallowing. And they had already done all the tests on her and determined that what she had was inoperable, but they didn't tell her. And my son came in to round on her, and she kept saying, I want water. And he said, you can't have water now. And she's like, she couldn't understand why she couldn't have water. No one had told her the results of her test. And my son walked in on this just not knowing any of this stuff. And so he had to be the one to tell her, we you know, there's no more medical intervention that we can do. That was so sad that they just, nobody really sat down and talked with this woman. They just sent a resident in, you know, and all of a sudden he's responsible for bringing this information to her. That's not respectful to a patient at all.
No, and it's so interesting in this time and age when of one's rights to ownership, be it privacy or what have you, that when it comes to one's own life, medicine actually doesn't necessarily disclose fully. It's criminal.
It is criminal. It's so sad. It's so tragic. I felt so bad for my son, but he said, "No, Mom, I handled it." You know.
that's where we end up, right? Is that there, thankfully, are wonderful people who feel an obligation to treat the person, not just the patient, and that their life and their body, and they deserve to have ownership and to be fully informed.
There are doctors who are there just to perform the, you know, the medical things or whatever, and then there's those who have the good bedside manner. And I tell you, you know, when it comes to doctors, I'll take the bedside manner over the experience any day, it's good to be heard. So, Death is But a Dream: Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. This book is wonderful, and where can we purchase this?
It's online now, actually, as a pre-order on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc. Its publication date is February 11th, but it can be pre-ordered now.
Oh, okay. Great. So I'm lucky to have had a pre-copy.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. So I have that. Any closing words?
No, I really want to commend you. I love what you picked out from the book to narrate the story. Thank you. You've done a great job of capturing it. If there's anything to close with, it's just that there's a better version of dying that we tend not to address, and that really is very paradoxically really positive and life affirming. This work is based on solid research. We have probably 5 or 6 published papers, but the data is told through patient stories. So I hope they're relatable and give the right message.
Well, they are, you know, because every story that you said, you know, made me think of something else. You know, I could definitely relate to them. And not only in the dying situation, but just in every kind of situation, you know, because we don't always know the right thing to say to people, and we don't always treat people the way that they're supposed to be, or, give them the dignity that they deserve. So your work is wonderful. I commend you for giving up all those years of cardiology and going to something this important, because this is so needed, and you're changing lives. So thank you, Dr. Kerr. It's been wonderful having you.
Thank you.
You are so welcome. Have a wonderful day. Keep up the beautiful work you're doing.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. So we are out of time today, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.